So as treasurer, I've been collecting the dues that have been coming in. Thanks for everybody who has paid, people who have not paid. Send it in when you can. We'd like to get a fairly full handle on who all is going to be members by January if we can, so we can send out a an annual book with a full list of membership.
Are you going to read the list of deadbeats there?
I did get a note from Jack Holtzeder, who has been a longtime member, informing me that he could no longer be a member. And this is one of the most charming no-sale notes I have ever received. So I wanted to share it with people, particularly since I think a lot of you know Jack. And Jack has spoken to the club several times and has been a member for a long time. So he basically says, I am one of the club's longest current members, I'm pretty sure, nearly 50 years of active membership. But immobility, hearing loss, and macular degeneration make continued membership impractical. He says, I came to Madlett as a consolation prize given by Harold Bud Nelson, then the director of the UW Journalism School, who felt guilty about not having arranged any financial support for me to finish my dissertation. He said, as a result, I had to work extra hard on my dissertation. Madlett was a break by comparison, and writing a paper for Madlett was, well, similarly, a comparative breeze. And I was among my kind. But while my brain churns nicely along, the rest of the package does not. It is time to turn in, metaphorically, my membership card, and to wish Madlett a continued splendid future. So,
very nice.
Thank you for all of your years of membership. We'll write to him and say that we wish him all the best, too.
Yeah, sure.
That's it.
All right.
And let's thank Jim for this past course.
Yes.
Nope.
Yes.
Nothing. Well, thank you. First, we have guests, right?
Glenn? I am.
Mm-hmm. Just quick intro. You're
from the Carlos. I live around the corner from him. That should be the selling point.
Exactly. So accounting, you know, why in the world? Having owned a small business and having been exposed in banks and lots of other arenas to accounting, I have always been fascinated by the topic. You know, it's where you find the dead bodies. It's where you find manipulation. It's where you find opportunities. You know, one of my favorite stories is the whole RJR thing when the takeover boom in the 80s, you know, and then the predators fall. And just, you know, people finding undervalued assets and on and on. So today, we have so many things that could use more attention. And I'm hoping tonight that both John and John can illuminate us on any number of topics. So I'm really thrilled that they agreed to take the time to talk about accounting and forensic accounting. And I don't think there's any two better people we can have. So with that, the floor is yours, Sean. And I can move this thing if you want.
I can hang here.
You don't have to stay
there the whole time.
No, I can just tell you when
I
have
this. All right.
The floor is yours. Yes.
All right. Well, thanks, Jim. And thanks for having us. And I'm watching the governance over here. You guys have some good governance in place. I appreciate that. So we're going to talk a little bit about governance and more importantly, bad governance. As Jim said, my name is Sean Carney. I am a retired, I'm a CPA. I was a longtime partner with RSM 38 years in the audit side of things. I retired during COVID. And now I'm actually the executive director for Catholic Charities here in Madison, a not-for-profit that I'm joined tonight by an active partner at RSM, a tax partner, John Davitt, a good colleague, great individual, got a bright, promising future ahead of him. So, John, thanks for taking time to supplement what I'm going to do. When Jim approached me about this a year ago and he said forensic accounting, I said, Jim, there's no way we're going to be able to put something together that's going to keep people's interest and attention on a Monday night. But he assured me we could. So First thing was, well, that's pretty boring. However, I said, we're going to do our best to actually make this a little more interesting, tell some more stories, if you will, and hopefully give you some insights and really speak to why this is should be important to all of us as citizens, and talk about some of the things that you either have heard about in the past, but more importantly, what you're hearing about today in the news when it comes to both accounting and issues regarding tax. So I'm going to kick it off with some of the accounting piece of that, or the auditing piece, I should say. So tonight's agenda. So basically, I wanted to review some of these more interesting fraud cases that we started in 1938. Trust me, we get to 1980 pretty quickly. Some of the common themes, who's responsible, changes that have come out of that and continue to come out of that, why you should care, what you can do as an individual, what's the future look like. And then Jim and I talked a little bit about how there's so many differences when we talk about accounting. You know, commercial accounting versus governmental accounting versus not-for-profit accounting, they're all different. They're all different sets of books. And tax accounting, which is another set of books. So a lot of times when you hear discussions about things that have gone wrong, it sometimes is, there's, you can get to the same answer in different ways. And so we'll talk a little bit about that, and then I'll turn it over to John to talk a little bit about income tax, their taxes, and some of the issues that are going on. So we're going to go back to 1934, which is what really established the public accounting world, which is what I was part of for almost 40 years. And those are external auditors that audit the corporate books, as well as non-for-profits, government, and so forth, depending on the set of rules. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the cases that really established some of the rules we live with today. So from the 34 Act with the SEC, we go to 1938, McKesson Robbins. McKesson is still around today, as some of you know, drug distributor, healthcare distributor these days, but back then it was primarily a drug manufacturer. And it was one of, and why am I talking about McKesson and Robbins? Well, when I graduated from accounting in 1983, we were still talking about McKesson and Robbins because it really was the original scandal that set a lot of the auditing standards into practice. From that scandal in 38 came statements on auditing standards. And two things came out of that were very important and to this day are still part of what auditors do. Number one, the inspection, the visual inspection of inventories, having to go and see the inventory. And number two, the independent confirmation of cash and receivables and that type of thing. So those two standards came out of the scandal in 38, in 38 for the McKesson and Robbins. So that was a situation where you had an individual that became president. He colluded with, I think they were some of his cousins and a brother. They basically had a whole set of books off the original books of entry, and they were inflating inventories, inflating assets, and the auditors were just taking their word for it. They would look at the documents were fraudulent, and the auditors would just take their word for it. And through that, they were able to siphon off profits, they were able to get loans and that type of thing. And it was in back then in the millions of dollars. And that really set the stage for the fact that the external auditors needed to do a better job, needed to put some standards in place that everybody used. And so I know when I got in the profession, that was always the fun thing, is you get to go out and observe inventories, which is always a fun thing, depending on some of those inventories could be very unique. So 1938, now we'll go to 1980. Crazy Eddie's. Crazy Eddie's was a retailer out on the East Coast, got a lot of attention back then. He was kind of a deal guy. He was selling appliances, that type of thing. And he was basically motivated by not paying taxes. So he was skimming off the top, and he was preparing falsified records so he didn't have to pay taxes. The problem with that was the deeper he got into it, and he also wanted to grow his business, he needed bank debt, he needed investors. And so his books were basically, he was falsifying the books. He was paying people off the books. And so now he was in a situation where to the IRS, he wanted to show no profit. To the banks and everybody else, he wanted to show a very healthy profit. Sounds familiar.
Yes.
Different sets of books. We've seen that happen recently. So when he went public, mm-hmm. this stuff all started to unravel. And there was collusion at every step of the way. The House of Goods finally fell due to a hostile takeover. Somebody came in 1988, wanted to buy the company. They started digging into the books, and they found out that they really weren't anywhere close to GAAP at that time. They were off millions of dollars. Crazy Eddie and his compatriots all went to jail at some point. As I look at, you know, why did nothing happen from, I shouldn't say nothing. There were scandals and that type of thing in the 30s, but why was it so prevalent in the 80s? Well, if you think about the 80s, all of a sudden the stock market started to take off, right? And so there's an incentive. And when we talk about fraud, there's always incentives to create a fraud. And it was really more not to steal, not the theft of assets we talk about typically with frauds, but manipulation of financial statements. And you're going to see that everything starting in the 80s is really all about manipulating financial statements, all the way through what's going on literally today as we speak. And it was all about getting a stock price and fooling the investors and the banking community and so forth. So that was Crazy Eddie. This next one, which this one spent a couple minutes on. I thought this one was kind of interesting. I don't know if you've heard of ZZ Best out in California. It was an individual, and he's still out there, Barry Minkow. He's now been to jail at least twice. Barry had a carpet cleaning business, and he somehow hooked up with an insurance adjuster. And they were young guys in their early 20s, I want to say, when they started doing this. And they were starting to file some fraudulent claims. They were starting to overcharge people. So they thought, well, this is a pretty good scheme. So they started this insurance restoration business, and it went public in 1986. And a little bit of it was legit, but for the most part, they were preparing phony sales documents, projects that didn't exist. So it was insurance restoration. Something happens, you know, you build the insurance company and you get the work done. What was interesting about this one, and they had actually Drexel and Burr, which was one of the investment firms at that time, which is already long gone. They had, into $40 million as far as the equity that they had put into this thing. So they started to get to that point where the bankers and the lenders wanted to get in there and see some of the projects and things that we're doing. Well, they were very effective at avoiding that. They were able to keep the bankers away, but Ernst & Whinney at the time, which is now E&Y, I'm old enough to remember those days, Ernst & Young, but it was Ernst & Whinney and Arthur Young Company, as the public auditors, they demanded as part of their audit to see a project. So they were on to some of the standards that needed to be done. They wanted to go visit standards. Triples or Barry, he signed a $2 million lease. So they wanted to go and see a project. Well, they didn't have this project that they had picked up. They said, hey, we want to go see this. It was in an office building out in California. They didn't have it, so they went and signed a $2 million lease on a building, hired a bunch of contractors, literally overnight, put together this phony restoration business. They paid the people at the building so that when, and the contractors, they gave all these individuals cash out of a pocket so that when they showed up with the auditors, they all acted like they'd been working on this, they knew him. It passed the audit test. I mean, I don't know how big the project was to sign a $2 million, and it was a 7-year lease on this building. So they basically constructed it overnight. It got past the auditors. The funny thing about this, so they were riding high and doing good. In the carpet cleaning business years back, they had many disgruntled customers, but they had somebody who was adamant to catch these guys, and she was mad because it was several hundred dollars that she'd been overcharged. And she kept on them. And ultimately, she took it to the LA Times. And it was one of those investigative stories. Mm-hmm. They did the story on it. And then that's when it all started to unravel, because the LA Times, the reporters realized that this was the same guy who now was into this ZZ Best. It brought the whole thing down, which I think is pretty interesting. And a lot of times you're seeing these fraud. That's what typically happens. It's something really insignificant or stupid happened, and these guys get caught. So that was in the 80s. He did jail time. When he got out of jail, and I want to say the mid-2010, something like that, he got in with Lanier, the big home builder, which is a And I have written down here, I don't exactly remember, I just looking some of these up. I think he was part of a $23 million fraud scheme with that one, so he went back to jail. And he got released a couple of years ago. I think he's early 60s. And so who knows what he's up to now. And the other thing, too, that, you know, comes with all of these is the tax charges. You know, they do these set of books. They're still liable for the federal taxes and the state taxes that haven't been paid. So when they're trying to do this stuff and they're preparing these fraudulent statements, they still have, they're still facing typical criminal charges from the IRS on top of the SEC. 1992, we get to Farmore. I don't know if some of you folks remember Farmore, the big pharmacy company that, or the big pharmacy retailer out there. Farmore was an incredible story. Again, it was a stock manipulation scheme where these guys, and they were legitimate at first, but they were doing discount, selling discount drugs, and everybody, including Walmart, was looking at them saying, how are they able to do this? They had these fantastic margins. Well, ultimately, they had $10 million of, or actually, they had almost a billion, they had $1 billion of fake inventory when the whole thing came out. But it took a while. And what was interesting there, and the reason I picked that one out, is that was the first time the auditors, back to the public accountants, there was a kind of a, not disgruntled, but an auditor at that time, Coopers and Lybrand, which is now PwC, PricewaterhouseCoopers. He felt like he had been passed over and he wasn't getting the credit he deserved for selling additional services. So he befriended the Farmore guys and they recognized, hey, we got somebody here. He started selling them a lot of services. And by doing that on this side of the table, he was also auditing over here. And they realized he's just going to kind of look the other way. He didn't know the extent of the frauds, but I think he was very lenient in what was going on at that time. So this is where the whole idea of auditor independence in 1992, I mean, we were always supposed to be independent, but this really brought it to the forefront that selling services at the same time you're auditing somebody, that's a huge conflict of interest. And you'll see even today now that isn't even allowed. Even tax services a lot of times are not allowed to be performed by the auditor. So that brought up the whole independence thing. Waste management, late 90s, that was another one that really was just manipulating earnings. And, you know, what was interesting about that time, and I was, at that time, I had a couple of public companies, so I remember these days now. We used to go to the annual SEC conference out in Washington, D.C., and they would refer to what waste management was doing as the cookie jar. And it was kind of a common practice, honestly, and it was more about, it wasn't accepted. I mean, it was accepted. It wasn't really in writing, but it was more about smoothing out earnings so that you had sort of this steady earnings each year. And so you had stuff on the balance sheet. And if, you know, the quarter didn't look good, then you'd release some of the reserves. And, you know, they were fairly open about doing that type of stuff. And that's what waste management kind of perfected it. And they had some really big swings, but their stock. And so this kept the stock price. And their reason for doing this was, well, you know, the investor doesn't need these shocks, and we need to have kind of a consistent pattern, and the markets will keep going up. But all of these were really aimed at keeping the stock price where it was for the investors, and I would say also for the CEOs and for some of the top management, because they all had stock options, which is what led to a lot of this. And so while they weren't stealing assets like we think of as, you know, the guys back in McKesson Robbins, they were inflating the stock price, and then they were using that as part of their compensation in that way. That's how they were through that. So that was 1999. All of a sudden in the profession, everybody's like, well, what's going on? Why aren't the auditors catching all of this stuff, right? And it was a fair question. And, you know, the in 99, I believe it was, sorry, 99, the profession started catching up, and for the first time in the public accounting world, There was acknowledgement of the F word, and the F word was dropped. And up until that time, the public accounting profession was pretty adamant about that the public accountants weren't hired to look for fraud. As a matter of fact, they said, you know, that's not part of our purview of looking for fraudulent transactions. If we come across it, we'll certainly report it, but that's not in our mandate, right? Well, there was a huge gap between that and the public perception. We said, what do you mean you're not hired to detect fraud? If there's fraud going on, who else is going to find it but the external auditor? So something called SAS 99 came out. 99 was the year it was passed, 1999. And interestingly enough, if all you remember, I put in here the granddaddy of them all. All of a sudden in 2001, 2002, come along Enron, WorldCom, and I'd even throw in, even though it was more the individual, Tyco, that name, Dennis Lazowski. Mm-hmm. That wasn't fraudulent, but it had a lot of the same characteristics. But it was enough that there was this whole, with Enron in particular, there was this whole scrutiny of the public accounting profession. The SEC jumped in. It really caused a significant change. A lot of the changes that we're still not only dealing with today, but that the profession is still working through today. So I put in here Enron, spend a couple of minutes on that. I think probably everybody in this room remembers Enron. What was interesting about Enron, while it was a definitely fraud, it was, I would say it was not the traditional fraud in that what they were doing, everything really did what was legal and it was accepted. They were using something called a special purpose entity or a, some of them call them sidecars or special purpose vehicles. You'll hear that term. And not unlike an LLC where you have another entity related to the main company that has another purpose to it. And as long as at that time, as long as it was thinly capitalized by the company and there was other ownership and no voting control by the company, you could have those. And Enron cooked up the scheme, Jeff Skilling, if people remember that name, Ken Lay. They cooked up the scheme of, boy, we can remove all the toxic assets and the liabilities on financial statements, put them in these special purpose entities, which were many. I don't remember the number, but it was tens, not hundreds, but somewhere close to 100 of these special purpose entities that all formed legally. And what was interesting is they went to the advice of, at that time, Arthur Andersen, which was considered the gold standard of accounting firms, auditing firms. And they actually spent a lot of time and they went through it. And they said, yeah, what you're doing, you know, there's nothing that's illegal about that you can't do it. Now, I would say you'd have to use what we used to call the reasonable man standard. You know, when you look at something, I mean, yes, it might be technically on paper legal, but if you look at it and realize that, you know, that's the intent of this, you have to look at it in its totality and say, wait a minute, something's not right here. And that's, you know, that was the first piece of it. They also adopted mark-to-market accounting, which at that time was not something that many companies were using. We were always taught historical base. They were marking stuff up. They weren't marking stuff down, which is also a lot of trouble at that time. So Enron fell apart. That really, and it fell apart very quickly, if you remember, 2001. And it really changed the whole industry. With that came Sarbanes-Oxley, because Congress got involved at that time. And Congress had said, look, public accounting profession, you are a private profession that's been hired to protect the public's interest. And you certainly haven't done that now. And we might just decide that, you know, you should be a unit of government, kind of like the TSA, you know, had been private up until 9/11. And all of a sudden, and that really scared the public accounting profession, because that was the last thing those of us in the profession wanted, was to be a unit of government. But that's what Sarbanes-Oxley really put forth. And it was sort of a compromise of, okay, we won't do that, but we're going to demand of the public accounting profession a lot of changes, pretty significant changes that we're still working through today, including, you know, making sure that the public accounting had to open their books. And probably the biggest thing to come out of was the PCAOB, ECOBOO, a lot of people refer to it as. And it really is the auditor of the auditors. So it's a division through the SEC. It actually audits auditors. It still is putting out a lot of the reports that you see. It's those of us in the profession at the time, and John not on the other side, but still probably hears a lot about it. It's not something that you want to really spend a lot of time having to deal with. They're a pretty tough regulator, I would say, and they have subpoena power, and they can file criminal charges and everything else, just like the SEC. So that came out of Enron. It was a significant change to the profession. The other thing that was significant, that's more on a personal level, if you remember, or maybe you don't, but at that time, most companies' 401k plans had, and predominantly, almost, they didn't require it, but they really encouraged employees to put most of it. If you had a 401k, they'd have the company stock as part of the plan, and you would put the company stock into the plan, in some cases 100% or 70% or 80%. Enron was very much that way. As a matter of fact, I think Ken Lay, there's some clips of him out there telling people, I would put everything you got. And that's when it was going down. The ship was going down. He knew it. The top guys knew it. And they said, put everything you got. And the employees bought it, hook, line, and sinker. They put everything they had. They lost everything. And that became then the Pension Protection Act of, I think it's 2006. Because they worked through it. And that's where companies, and they become much more robust at a, I mean, there is still, I think, the option to have company stock, but they really, that they have to provide employees with what they're putting in there. They have to provide them with other options. They can't just put all their stock in there, basically fund it under the 401k. So that was a significant change. And then Arthur Andersen, again, number one probably firm at the time. That, we went from the Big Eight when I started to the Big Five for a while, which included Arthur Andersen, and then quickly Andersen went down. Ultimately, Andersen was not found guilty. They were found innocent of the charges. I mean, I don't think the whole firm should have gone down. The people involved should have been disciplined, which they were. But the problem is, in any professional services firm, once you lose your credibility, which they had lost at that point, it's hard to keep clients. And so they pretty much, within 6 months, I would say, they had lost all of their large clients, and they had to liquidate at that time. So that was something unique. The other thing that came out of that I always found interesting, and I just remember watching it, there was really no record retention policies for the profession, at least for us and for the companies back in that time period. I still remember the pictures of when the whole Enron thing was flaring up, and Andersen realized that their documents were part of that, and were all going to be used in discovery. They had, I remember, like garbage, like the big Shred-X trucks lined up all day and all night. If you remember the pictures of those things, and it was legal. There was no, nowadays, I mean, record retention for any profession is so important. And it's watched, I mean, everything, and the technology makes it such that you can see the last time somebody was in a document and all that type of stuff. Back then, they were bringing out garbage cans full of documents because they realized at that point that they had probably overstepped the authority. So out of that came record retention. We all had to, for good reasons, we all had to follow a lot of record retention, and a lot of cases came out of that. So, Arthur Andersen also, Enron also set the standards for corporate internal controls, financial statement accuracy, making the CFO sign off on financial statements, which is where we're at today, which is a much improved, the expectation now is that not only will management prepare accurate statements, but that the auditors will also do a good job auditing them and bringing to the public what needs to be known. So WorldCom, a little bit of the same thing that came along in 2002. They had what they call prepaid capacity, which is a cookie jar. Basically, they would watch earnings, and then if things were not going the way they wanted, or if they were too much, they would. The prepaid capacity was a fixed asset that they would kind of mess with. And one of their internal auditors couldn't understand it, and they actually got upset with her, and they explained what it was, and she just didn't think it smelled right. And so she kept going at it, and finally she became a whistleblower, kind of a famous case. And Bernie Ebers was the CEO at that time, and this was kind of his scheme. All these schemes at that point came from the top down, and they were all meant to basically manipulate the stock price. So take it away. And I just mentioned Tyco. I remember people remember Tyco with Dennis Kozlowski. I think he's still out there. I think he just wrote a book. He was the one that had the $6,000 curtain charge. Remember that? And the $15,000 brass what was it, a brass umbrella stand, and in his apartment, in his $30 million apartment in New York. And he's also the one that had the $2 million birthday bash for his wife over in some island. Now, he says today that that was misunderstood, and he didn't know they were going to spend that much. But those kinds of things were going on. It caught the regulator's eyes. Fast forward then to Bernie Madoff. We've all heard about Bernie. There's not a lot to say about Bernie, except Bernie was a sharp guy. He gained trust from everybody. And the reason he didn't get caught is because he really wasn't required at that time to be filing anything. And he had been the head of, I think it was, I don't remember what regulatory body was, but it was a regulatory body that he was able to escape. He had put his imprint on it that the types of services that he was doing that didn't need to be audited and didn't need to be regulated the way everybody else did. So that's why he was able to get fined. And there's a couple of good documentaries out there that I've seen with the Netflix Liberty Machines. It's really fascinating how he was able to have a whole second set of books. He had a whole floor full of people working for him that were creating his all the Ponzi scheme. And until the markets all dropped, I mean, it all, it worked for a long time. So, but he wasn't even in there. One that I want to tell you about, which I think was an interesting one. I don't know if you remember Rita Crunwell, 2011, the city of Dixon, Illinois, which isn't too far from here, Ronald Reagan's hometown. Remember the trusted treasurer down there? So Rita Crunwell, and I had come from, and John did too, from the Rockford office. So we kind of knew about this story back when it was bubbling up in 2011. Ultimately, Rita had embezzled $54 million from the Dixon. Think about that. Over a period of like 30 years, but $54 million. Dixon is not that big, let me tell you. Yes. Rita was the trusted treasurer. She was appointed in 1983 out of high school. She worked for the mayor's office. Everybody loved her. Early on, though, she opened up an account called the Reserve Sewer Capital Development Account, which ironically had her home address on the account, on the bank account. Okay, started out pretty small. She was, again, trusted. One of the comments about a year before she got caught was, one of the city council members said, Rita treats every dollar in this city like it's one of her own. You know, that came back to bite him. The other thing that I thought was kind of funny with Rita, she was so well-liked. And I don't know if you remember the story, but the $54 million went to her horse racing, or her horse breeding and racing habit that she had. And she was nationally known throughout the country. And people did wonder, what is the treasurer of Dixon doing, you know, living? And she, her lifestyle was out there. She had a big coach, one of those camper, not campers, but motorhomes. She would go across the country, and she would chalk it all up to, hey, she's done well in horses, right? Well, I don't know if anybody's, I don't know that much about horses, but I used to do it in textures, folks that had horses. You don't always make money. As a matter of fact, I think you usually lose money. That's a hobby that you get a really problem. So they should have understood that. And and they should have also, another couple of things there, the accountant, the accounting firm at that time that was doing her work also did her personal return. And it came out when this whole thing fell apart. She had hundreds of thousands of dollars that she was deducting on her personal return that had absolutely no receipts to it. So she was not paying any taxes. She had this horse racing business. She was defrauding the city. But the funny thing was, is so what? When she would go on vacation, they were so not proud of her, but they were appreciated the fact that she would always ding her pay. Or she went off, took an afternoon or one, and did something with the horses. She would make sure her pay was adjusted so that she didn't get paid for it. And here she was getting away with $54 million. Mm-hmm. Finally, happened. Typical way these frauds get caught. She went on an extended trip with the horses. The person that filled in for her, she had told the person that filled in for her to make sure she reconciled the bank statements. Well, all the bank statements that came to the city, of which there were many, she was doing that, but she didn't really think through it. She called up the bank and said, hey, when you have a chance, send me all the bank statements. She didn't know what she was asking for, but ultimately, send me all the bank statements under our name. Somebody at the bank center, all of them, including this reserve capital fund. She opens that thing up, and it's got these millions of dollars of transfers going in and out. Went to the mayor. Of course, they did. Well, they kind of knew what they had, but they had to sit on it for 6 months because they had to get the FBI involved. You know, they had to track the whole thing. And so she worked there for another 6 months in the treasurer's office, and they all knew what she was up to. They came down. She actually just got released from prison not too long ago. but they, you know, they came down on, certainly on her, but they came down on the accounting firm, which there was some very obvious things. Number one, I mean, one of the basic things we used to always do is you'd send a request to the bank and ask for all the statements that the bank has under the name of whoever you're auditing for just this reason. And evidently that hadn't been done, or if it was, and the bank was also in trouble too, because they were accepting, you know, checks that somebody should have said, this doesn't make sense for the city, especially a small city like that, where they probably know each other. But, you know, trusted Rita, and she got dinged for a time, so she was good there. Oh, and she also, there was an independence thing with the auditors. She also played on the auditor's softball team. It was a pretty good player. And so they, auditors, again, she befriended them to the point where they didn't ask the right questions. So that one was interesting. Going forward, I'm moving along here a little bit. Let's see what's the next.
Yeah. So the problem's fixed, common themes, trustworthy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so the the last two that are going to happen, yeah, why should I'll get to that. But the ones that are interesting now that just came up just within the last couple of weeks, the state of Arizona, I thought this was interesting a couple of weeks ago. The state of Arizona, the attorney general of Arizona is filing a lawsuit, and it's a pretty significant, in $40 million, I want to say, against one of the county, or against the county, excuse me, the county's filing it against the state auditor, because the state auditor didn't catch a $40-some million fraud in one of the counties down in Arizona. And it's interesting what goes around comes around. It's because for years she never independently verified the bank accounts, like you were, you know, McKesson Robbins, that's what came out of that. So that's why they're suing her. So you have one unit of government suing another unit of government saying, hey, you missed this. This person defrauded them from $42 million. The other one that's very interesting that just came out, it's more of an investigation. I think we're supposed to hear this week. So Macy's, I don't know if any of you saw that, about 3 weeks ago, the Macy's department store didn't release earnings one day when they were supposed to, because they found an accounting manipulation, and it was a lower level accountant. It's $153 million over 3 years, which is a small amount because it was specific to the delivery expenses, which is about a $4 billion account. It's $153 million. Nobody knows what happened yet. It doesn't make sense that they would have taken anything, and I think that would have been caught. My suspicion is she was either covering for somebody else, or they had promised earnings at some level in some department. It's a small enough number over that period of time. It could get by without the auditors noticing it, but they're actually going to release that this week. So these frauds are out there. They keep coming. And, we'll probably see more. So why should you care? Everyone in this room, I assume, has something related to the markets, probably retirement plans, or their bank accounts. You have something that you're relying on someone else, regulators, and in a lot of cases, public accountants, to audit those and give you assurance that what you have is accurate and is protected. So I think you all have that responsibility, I mean, to ask questions. Some things I was just going to mention quickly. If you No, I'm sorry. I go back up this way. Sorry. There you go. You had that in there. So relying on that. Yeah. So if you're a board member of certainly a commercial company or a board member of a not-for-profit, make sure that you, number one, make sure that there's, if it's of a size, if there's audits being done, make sure you're looking at the 990s, go to GuideStar, ask questions. If things don't make sense, just keep asking the questions. A lot of these things would have been caught a lot earlier had you asked the right questions. Read the materials. If you're an investor, when you get the 10-Ks, the 10-Qs, the annual proxy statements, skim through them. You know, they put too much information in there. A lot of that came from Enron, but it is a lot of good information, how the decisions are made. And, you know, the people that are on the board and the board members are supposed to now be certainly in the financial piece of it. If you're a board member, you have to have a certain expertise. So take a look at all of that. It's important. Future of auditing, AI is going to come in. COVID. We're starting to see some things with COVID, I think, and you're going to see more and more, I think, of frauds, because during COVID, we all were sent home literally in the middle of audits, and it took a while to adjust. And I think people that are bad actors out there have taken advantage of that. And now it's all starting to come out. And we're starting to see that. Jim just sent me an article today, or sent us an article that talked about some of that that's going on. And then a couple of minutes real quick, government commercial. You know, the funny thing is, you know, I hear these comments. So when you get about government accounting financials, I remember a few years ago, and I don't remember which administration. I think it was maybe from the Doyle to the Walker. It was a change in administration. Somebody had a $3 billion surplus, and somebody read it and said, no, it's like a $2 billion deficit. And they were both right, because somebody was looking at it from a government accounting standpoint, budgetary basis. And on the last day of the year, before all the bills got paid, yes, it was $3 billion surplus. The next day, you know, there was like a $6 million went out in payments. They've closed the gap quite a bit, but for a long time, you know, like debt was not on the books of governments. Even pension plans, that was only in 2014. So that's why you're seeing all this discussion about how unfunded pension plans are. Luckily, in Wisconsin, we're one of the number, either one or two, I think, of the number one. Okay. Of the best funded plan in the country. Illinois is the worst.
Yeah.
We came out of Illinois.
Don't blame us.
No, I know.
We got out.
Yeah, you get, we got out. But, you know, the reason that just kind of fell under the radar. So, ironically, until 2014, those unfunded liabilities weren't even on the financial statements. So that's back to the government accounting. Same thing with the budgetary basis. The idea with government accounting is it's like a flow of funds basis. It's not necessarily a pool like we have in the commercial world. So the government looks at it this way and says, well, every year we have a built-in revenue base because we have a tax base. They're the only people that can actually, you know, legally tax. So they've got revenue to pay for the debt. And so it's really more about the budget, making sure they pass a budget and they stay within those budget guidelines. But it's kind of like the rest of the balance sheet's way over here. And it'll get paid in some future because they've got a tax base to pay it. So conceptually, that makes sense. But it doesn't make sense when you run into things like this pension. And I think that's why for so many years, the units of government, Chicago, being one of them, was able to kind of raid those funds, or not raid them, but not fund them to the point they should be. Now they're less than 50% funded. I don't know how we'll ever get out of that. It's $5 trillion or something. It's $1 trillion, but it could be up to $5 trillion. So,
any quick questions for Sean before we flip up to move over the job?
That one question.
Yes, sir.
Say that individuals all review the statements.
Yes.
But you also say the statements are much more complicated. Should you retain a professional to read the statements? Are there such professionals? Is it cost effective to retain them?
That's a good question. I guess it depends how, you know, from a, like a personal, like from an investing standpoint, or from a board.
No, not from a board.
No, from a personal standpoint. Well, I would say, you know, that's where using an outside, either counsel or a broker, they should be able to walk you through the things that are really important. I don't think it's the complexity is that there's a lot in there, but there's some key things. Number one, you always look for if there's a statement about the control structure, what the report from the auditors was, is it clean, does it have any qualifications, that type of thing, some of the high level stuff. And I would ask, I mean, whoever the investments or the company is, but I would ask the questions about, do you have, first of all, do you have unqualified opinions? Do you have control structure violations, which are, you know, the control structure is in place to catch some of the more significant errors, that type of thing. Are there, I mean, that's, you know, what a CPA should be able to do. I guess it depends, you know, how significant it is as retaining someone to work with.
I have one question. I was actually at Cooper's Monogram from 91 to about 94.
Okay.
And so when the Farmore thing hit,
okay,
I was on the consulting side, financial consulting, and the go-to used to be to talk to the audit partners to try to get business from the audit clients. And all of a sudden, iron curtain.
Yep.
Couldn't do that at all anymore. Because you were right. I mean, you know, the whole idea was just, what more services can we sell? That was the daily question. So how has that evolved, you know, over the last 20 years? What's the relationship of PricewaterhouseCoopers with their large clients in terms of the breadth of services they're providing?
So for the most part, I mean, there, certainly on the public side, it got shut down years ago. Even on the private side, well, when I say private companies, that companies would think are here on their own privately, there is very little of any ability to sell consulting to the same firm. And even tax services now are getting tricky, right? And John
heads on the tax side. Yeah, and really anything that a consultant or someone else would be doing that would be like making management decisions, right? So if you're helping them redo how they account for things, or maybe you're installing a new software that's going to keep track of their financial records, you can't then audit something that you help create. So they try to put up walls, but we've seen things even like EY that have split into firms recently. So they took their whole tax and consulting practice, put it over here and said audit over here, and the employees at the firm said, you know, that this is our whole growth structure. What do we do now? But they saw that, hey, maybe we could make more money if we're completely disjointed and then could sell more services to these kind of friendly relationships. So it's kind of interesting.
There's a lot of them doing that as far as splitting them
up.
I have a small question, literally small. I am associated with a lot of nonprofit organizations, but they make less than $50,000 a year.
Okay.
At what point do organizations have to have an independent audit?
You know, there's a lot of different, there's no necessarily cutoff. Typically, if an outside party, typically they're getting state money or they're getting monies through another entity, like they get none of that.
No.
Then I don't remember what the Secretary of State here is, but I know in Illinois it was at least $300,000 of revenue. It was even higher.
Okay.
Definitely not 50.
Anybody need 500 grand now?
Was it 500?
Get a remedy. Or if you just feel that you don't, there's too much. If there's too much going on that you just don't even feel like you can root through the statements clearly, might be worth the review, but.
In a non-for-profit bank's size, and so the best thing to do is just to keep an eye on the bank statements, really. That's what I've always said, because that's where those frauds are going to come through, and just making sure that it makes sense, and typically having being copied on them, even if you're not looking at them, the people that are doing the work think that you're looking at them. So, that's a lot of the deterrence. Same thing with the others that come out of the air, you know. People don't know what they're looking at. They're not supposed to telegraph what they're looking at, especially with inventories, because look what happens.
Thank you.
All right, let's do it. That's a good job.
Thank you, Sean. Sorry, it took all the Jen's
done. No, you're good. See, we got 10, 20 minutes? 10, 15 minutes?
Oh, half hour.
Well, for the next 2 hours, I'd like to talk tax law and policy.
Why don't I do that?
We'll do a switcheroo.
Yep.
All right. Here we go.
Can get all the credit.
All right. All right. Now, so what I was hoping to talk through today is tax controversy, expectations for tax policy. I'm trying to think, if I wasn't a nerdy tax accountant, what would I care about after maybe the election, about fraud that's going on, other things that are kind of interesting. So a lot of slides here, but we'll just move through them quickly and chat about a few. Kind of interesting items. So you all have probably heard a lot about IRS activity, and I know there were some news articles about, you know, IRS agents carrying weapons and exciting things, you know, in the tabloids. But we are seeing an uptick on IRS audits, and there's some specific things that they're looking for with businesses. So there's a lot of benefits and other deductions that a lot of companies in Wisconsin take advantage of, and we're seeing a lot of scrutiny placed on them. One is the research and development tax credit. So if anyone is out producing new or improved products, like a manufacturing company, maybe you're at Epic and you're taking advantage of software development, web development, you can get a pretty lucrative tax credit that can offset your taxes. This has been around since the 90s, but recently there's been a lot of boutique consulting firms that will come in and say, hey, we'll give you $500,000 in credit. We're only going to take 30% of that, you know, as a fee. And so they're buckling down on that a bit. Some other items around inventory, kind of going off of what Sean was saying. Business interest expense limitations. So currently, legislation doesn't allow you to deduct all of your interest expense that you might have as a business. And some people are trying to find some workarounds around that or ignoring certain rules. But let's move forward here. I think there's some more exciting items we can get to. So I'm sure everyone's heard the infomercials maybe about employee retention tax credits and some of the items that came out of COVID and the CARES Act. This has been very helpful for certain qualified businesses who were forced to shut down or experience significant, you know, delay in business. You know, we've you know, as an accounting firm, done a lot of these credits. And the way it works is if someone had a 50% drop in gross receipts in 2020 compared to 2019, you could potentially qualify for this. Or if you had a significant disruption, meaning that the government order said, you have to close your business, you can't serve people in person, great. Well, similar to other fraudulent schemes, people took advantage of this and said, oh, this is real dollars coming in. Mm-hmm. And so I would say an average manufacturer in Wisconsin that might have qualified for this credit, they might have received, you know, between $500,000 up to maybe $4.5 million of cash coming from the IRS in the form of a check. And then we saw a lot of bad actors coming out there that would say, well, let me do that for you. You know, we're just going to take 20 to 30% of that. So 25% on $4 million for, you know, maybe 4 hours of work is a pretty, pretty good fee. And so then you looked at some of the accounting firms with the higher standards, and we might have been charging time and material, you know, maybe $4,000 or $5,000 to do this study that someone else is paying $400,000 for. But some interesting facts, really, as of September of 2023, they had already processed 28,000 claims worth $2.2 billion and already found 14,000 fraudulent claims worth $1 billion. If you fast forward in May 2024, they've initiated 450 criminal cases, and they estimate fraudulent claims worth nearly $7 billion today. So that's people setting up fake companies, just not doing the qualifications right. And unfortunately, for a lot of small business owners, sometimes just trusting the wrong person, you know, one of these boutique firms. So now there's 30,000 letters out there, and we're seeing a big pause on this. And we could jump through the qualifications since I kind of touched on that, Jim, but it's now been added to the IRS's Dirty Dozen. So if you're ever interested in what the tax schemes are these days, you can go to the IRS website. They list their Dirty Dozen. This is one of them. They typically saw that businesses were claiming more quarters than were allowed. They were relying on government orders that don't qualify or exist. Too many employees in a calculation. And one of my favorites is this last one. I had a lot of people call me that I would have a conversation with. I said, hey, it's a great opportunity. Unfortunately, you don't qualify under these rules. I've looked at your financials. We fully talked about it. I said, well, I talked to someone at this firm, and they said the IRS wants me to have this money. I deserve it. I'm going to get it. And I said, well, that's fine, but I'm not doing it. You know, so we saw some really funny sales tools. And, you know, hopefully overall, I do think the program and a few others really did help a lot of honest businesses, which were great. But we saw a lot of funny things come out of it. And now we're seeing a lot of litigation and a lot of enforcement come back out of it. One of the other things around the IRS I thought was interesting was the Inflation Reduction Act funding. So this really had plans to increase the audit rate. So kind of over more to Sean's role, but really auditing taxpayers' tax returns by 22%. About $80 billion was approved here to help improve the IRS. Now, if you ask me, a lot of times, has anyone here called the IRS?
It's impossible.
Yeah, sit on hold for a while.
Days.
So some of the questions now post-election are, what are we going to do with all this money? Are we going to continue to increase enforcement? Or are we going to hire more people to answer the phone? Because we haven't even gotten customer service down. They probably need both. But if you scroll down here, I thought it was kind of interesting. Here is their rating, how they're going to appropriate some of this money. You can see the largest, it's very small here, but the largest section here, focus on expanded enforcement, is $41 billion they plan to spend. And so some of this has been questioned on, you know, is this going to happen? We have a new administration coming in. We have a majority coming into, you know, the House and with the Senate. So some people are saying that they think maybe this will be repositioned, maybe less on enforcement, more on customer service, but we'll have to see what happens here. If you want to keep scrolling, Jim, mm-hmm. there's one more slide here. And again, this is kind of breaking out the estimated spend. This is through 2031. So each year they're planning to spend a little bit more, but you can see a large uptick here, specifically in operation support enforcement. So I'm really hoping that it becomes a little bit more taxpayer friendly, because we have a lot of people that are just frustrated that we can't get to them. Sometimes we'll do an amended tax return for someone where they overpaid tax, they have a large refund,
and we wait 18 months to see a check. And so it's pretty frustrating, I think, for a lot of people in businesses. So we're hoping that either additional funding or whatever is going to happen at the IRS here, it'll be an interesting year. We'll see. But along the lines of enforcement, I think it's really interesting. You know, we have so many great businesses in Wisconsin, so many great manufacturing businesses, software businesses, and a lot of our clients are international now. You know, they might own a facility in China, Hong Kong, somewhere else. What's happened over time is, you know, anytime they say, let's simplify the tax code, I'm scared, you know, because it never gets simpler. It always gets more complex. And with these, we run into a lot of companies where maybe they're, you know, with the tax preparer they've been with a long time, or they're just not aware of the rules, where there's these new foreign reporting forms where on a U.S. tax return, you need to report the activity of maybe a foreign-owned corporation or something like that. And we run into it a lot where it's missed. And you can see how seriously the IRS is taking it. So per form missed, they're now charging $10,000 for the one form, $25,000 for 5472. And so obviously we've seen an uptick in enforcement, but we've also seen an increased, you know, penalty and things like that. One other item on the international tax perspective I thought was interesting. Oh, that slide got a little goofy. But there's this new thing called Pillar 2 you might read about in the paper. But essentially, there's 140 countries that have come together, and they're trying to create a global minimum tax of 15%. Maybe you've heard of that. That would be in effect for some countries, you know, starting years 2024. And really what it would be is a 15% kind of top-up tax if they're not paying enough. And so that would really target companies that are, I think it's 745 million euros, really almost close to $1 billion companies. So probably not a lot of our, you know, family-owned businesses around here, but some of them, and then some of the large public companies. So you'll see some interesting things there. We move down. I wanted to talk a little bit just about what's happening in the tax world, because this is, for a tax nerd, a very exciting time or year. We had, back under the Trump administration, a lot of tax cuts under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, but they also came with some somewhat negative repercussions for businesses too. A lot of those tax cuts are set to expire at the end of this year. And so a lot of businesses are starting to panic and figure out, okay, do I need to change the structure of my business? Do I need to start planning for this? And there's been a lot of bills put together over the past 4 years, like the Build Back Better plan and others, that tried to fix or solve or create a solution for some of these issues. And as you know, most of those fell apart. And so we do actually expect to see some action here in the next month or two around tax policy. So I just want to go over a couple of those items to kind of watch for. And if you're saying, hey, John, this is too technical, or back it up, just tell me to stop, or we'll jump into something else. But some interesting points here. In 2017, the federal debt was at $21 trillion. In 2025, we're at $36 trillion already. Interest rates were 1.1%. Now they're at 4.8%. And, you know, we don't really expect to see a lot here in the last remaining days of Joe Biden's presidency, just as far as tax legislation, this lame duck period. But Congress is starting to get together to figure out how they're going to address some of these items come January, February. So if you scroll down here, Jim, I just want to highlight a couple of key items that were cuts in 2017 that are going to go away here in the next year. One is the individual tax rate. The highest individual tax rate was cut from 39 to 37%. There was an increased standard deduction on your tax return. There was also an increase in the exemption amount for individual alternative minimum tax, child tax credits. Probably one of the biggest ones that, as a tax nerd, I see every day, but not everyone thinks about. If you remember back in 2017, they cut the corporate tax rate to 21%, which is a big deal. And then on the pass-through entity side for our partnerships and S-Corps, they created this 20% pass-through deduction. So if you're getting a K-1 that goes on your tax return or some other item like that, this effectively lowers your tax rate. And that's set to go away. So a lot of family-owned businesses are really worried right now. Do we need to figure out a different structure? Are we going to pay our tax? Is this going to be extended? We think after the election, it's pretty likely that this will be extended.
But that's one of the big bargaining chips that's out there right now. So Jim, let's scroll down a little bit. This is a really important thing. The other big item that was extended was the lifetime estate and gift exemption.
Yes.
So maybe you're familiar with that, but right now through 2025, an individual can give away or exclude from their estate up to $13.9 million. A married couple can exclude $27.9 million. That's set to be cut back down to $7 million for individual and $14 million for couple after 25. So a lot of people are starting to do some last minute gifting. If you didn't have an estate plan, people are thinking about, is there any planning around there? That could be extended as well, but that's a sunsetting provision. Yeah, we can keep going here. So I thought this was interesting. When we look at how is Congress going to look at all these tax cuts, I want to know what is the price tag? You know, what do these things actually cost? But over a 10-year period, the state and local tax deduction is about $1.2 trillion. So that's where they capped your state and local tax deduction at $10,000. Do you remember that? So property tax, other payments, it's capped. That creates $1.2 trillion of revenue for the IRS. So that's a big bargaining chip that they may not want to get rid of, even though it's set to expire. Some personal exemptions are $1.6 trillion. The individual rates alone were a $1.8 trillion impact. So if you scroll down here, Jim, there's a few other items here. A big item that most manufacturers around the country are upset about is this thing called Section 174 R&D expensing. So before this all happened, if someone was creating new products, they could deduct the wages for their engineers, deduct the costs for their project, and they could get a tax credit. They decided that to pay for a lot of these tax cuts, instead, now you're not able to deduct those costs, whether you claim a credit or not. You have to capitalize them and amortize them over 5 years if it's a domestic expense and 15 years if it's foreign. So there's been millions and millions of dollars poured into lobbying for this bill because a lot of U.S. manufacturers are saying, hey, I can barely pay my tax. I'm paying my engineers. I can't even deduct those costs. Help me out. So that's going to be something that's really going to be negotiated here in the next couple months. All right, let's see if we've got anything else exciting here. The cost to make these permanent. So if we took all these tax cuts and we said, you know what, we like some of these, let's just keep them in place, is about $4.6 trillion that it would add, plus $600 billion in interest expense. So as we think about the deficit we're in, we got to do something here. But the interesting thing is, with the Senate majority, House majority, and now the administration with Republicans, they'll probably be able to pass something. But the traditional method would require that they have 60 votes in the Senate, and they don't have a large enough majority for that. So what we're going to have to see Congress do is go through what we call the budget reconciliation process, which you're all probably very familiar with. So all these are going to be negotiated, and what's going to happen is because everyone campaigned on extending a lot of these items, I think we're going to see some really creative revenue raisers, right? They're going to have to come up with some offsets to these tax cuts. And I think one I read about the other day that I thought was kind of funny was someone proposed making municipal bond interest not tax exempt anymore.
Right.
So I don't think some of these are going to happen, but we're just going to start to see some really creative, weird tax planning potentially. And then speaking of legislation, I thought I'd share this funny. Let's see. It's kind of a funny story, but during the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and again, this is a rumor, didn't hear it from the accountant, but they were desperate for revenue raisers, what we call pay-fors, right? They had all these tax cuts. They're like, how can we raise some money? Apparently, they had a group of Senate staffers working late one night, coming up with things. And previously, if you paid alimony, after a divorce, that was deductible, but then your former spouse would have to pick that up as income. They decided no longer will that be tax deductible. So maybe the spouse who has to pay the alimony, who's in the highest tax bracket or a higher tax bracket, is not going to be able to deduct this. We're going to get more tax revenue. It's going to be great. Well, apparently one of the main Senate staffers was in the middle of a divorce when this happened. And so all the other effective dates in this section were all for January 1st, 2018, but they're sitting there in January drafting a bill.
And so the rumor is that that is the reason why the date for alimony is effective January 1st, 2019, and everyone before them is grandfathered in. So we don't know that to be true, but that is the rumor on the Hill. I can mention a couple other things, but I want to be sensitive of time. So let me know if you want me to keep going or want me to wrap up.
Keep going.
Keep going.
Okay. All right. Okay.
8 minutes or 10 minutes or so. Sure.
Okay. Well, I thought this was interesting, right? So we don't know what's going to happen in the future, right? It's politics in the U.S., right? A lot of things could happen, but we do have some things we know. We know what's going to expire in the tax code. We know what was permanent, and we know what the campaign ran on the Trump administration for, you know, what they promised to do or would like to do. And so I thought we'd just look at that to see what will we be seeing come down the pipeline, whether it happens or not. One is he'd like to reduce the corporate tax rate from 21% to 15% for qualified businesses that make products in the U.S. and 20% for all other corporations. With all the other tax cuts and things that need to be handled, I'm guessing that's probably not going to happen, but we might see something around it. The other was exempting tip income from income tax and social security taxes. I know that was something that the Harris administration and Trump administration both proposed. I don't know about you, but I'd love to be paid then in tip income. So I think that's one that has a lot of loose ends that probably, I say that, but I actually got together with a Senate staffer maybe 2 weeks ago, and he said they were drafting a bill around tip income. So we'll see what happens. It might be the Wild West here. Exempting Social Security benefits from income taxes is one that they're also looking at. And then these remaining items are really focused on most of the business tax exemptions and the increased lifetime estate exemption. The important thing to note on those two items, these sunsetting provisions, is they'll all have to go through that budget reconciliation, right? It's not something that you can campaign on and then you just flip the switch and it works, but it will probably be a part of their, you know, proposed bill. So that should be interesting to see.
Can I ask a question
before? Yeah.
So the Social Security exemption thing. What's your projection for that?
You know, I haven't heard as much pushback on that as I have on the tip income and the other items. I think if they were to do something around that, it would be narrowed down to specific either classes or not earning income elsewhere, or perhaps by income that it might be exempt under a certain threshold. I think Social Security alone, right, has its own challenges around funding right now. So I don't think that it's impossible if they would do something, but I think there will be a narrowing of focus, right? Similar to these clean energy credits that they kind of promised us. And then, you know, they said, okay, well, if you install a charging station in your business, you know, you'll receive this credit. You go to file the credit, and then you realize that only works in economic development zones. So a lot of times for my clients that are 30 miles outside Stevens Point, Wisconsin, and no one at the factory drives a Tesla, you know, so I'm not sure, but it'll be interesting to see. I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that.
No, except, it's near and dear to my heart. They already have, there's a provision in there, right? We're not all of us taxable, and our threshold's already in there. So it's kind of messy, it seems to me. So everything I've heard, I mean, I think they're going to, you know, it's a good segment of the population, and I would guess ARP is going to have a lot to say about it, and they're going to want to see part of it. So my guess is, like most of it, like you said, they'll mess with it, but I don't think it'll ever be fully 100% non-taxable. That would be my guess.
Yeah. And classic politics thing. Yeah. Declare victory with something small that's almost meaningless. Tax you more elsewhere, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. But it would be a nice benefit if it went through.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So I just put a slide in here. What's next? You know, we mentioned this a little bit earlier. We're going to see some disaster relief probably come through from President Biden. Again, without the 60 votes, we're going to see budget reconciliation. Congress has released kind of their 100-day plan. Under the Harris administration, we expected to see this first wave of tax policy come out next November, December, because they would have been motivated by the sunsetting provisions. Under this administration, because they have the control to move on it, it sounds like they're going to start January, February, maybe vote in March. So there should be things coming. I think this is important too. If they don't do anything, 62% of taxpayers will feel an increase in their tax burden by 2025. So no one wants to get fired, right? I think they're all going to try and do something. Hopefully it impacts, you know, most people in the country favorably.
And this is interesting. If they do nothing, the old law goes back into effect. Mm-hmm. The pre-Trump tax law goes back into effect. And that's going to trigger the higher taxes. But the only way the Trump administration is going to get new tax law is through reconciliation.
Right.
Reconciliation requires budget neutrality.
Right.
Where the hell are they going to get budget neutrality?
Well, that's going to be the fun answer, right?
Serious.
that's been wrong, right? And yeah. And so an interesting thing with that is, so the budget reconciliation process, right, goes into effect for 4 years, and then those benefits are typically, it could be structured differently, but typically those tax benefits are put in place for 4 years, but the measuring period is 10 years, right, to be neutral. So often what happens is we do it for 4 years, they go away, IRS doesn't receive all the revenue, they put another budget reconciliation, right? We never get to neutral. But one interesting thing was the state local tax deduction, that $10,000 cap on your taxes, that actually was initially going to be excluded from the TCJA, and the entire thing was going to fall apart. The Democrats at the time, I can't remember which person that was, but someone made the point that this is a state and local tax issue. This isn't a budgetary issue. It shouldn't belong. And apparently, I'm talking with folks that are former Senate staffers, and I don't understand the full process, but apparently the way that came down to a decision was not by even a congressman or woman. It was a staffer that is nominated to the place of making these types of decisions in a vote. When they're basically the tiebreaker. So an unelected official actually said, yes, we can do it. And then TCJA went through. But that state local tax deduction is probably one of the only beneficial things, one of the main beneficial things that's actually set to expire. So if nothing happens come 2025, you can deduct more than $10,000. The other interesting workaround we've seen that we do a lot of planning with is that most states recognize that as an opportunity. And they said, hey, people can't deduct all these taxes for a partnership or an S corporation that doesn't normally pay tax at the business level, right? The income's pushed out, the individuals pay the tax. They created what they call pass-through entity elections. So a business can elect to pay the tax at the business level and then pass through a credit to the owners. It's kind of a workaround. So the businesses still get the deduction for state taxes. And I would say probably over 40 states now have some type of pass-through entity deduction or election that you can make year to year to do that, to get the benefits still to owners. And so, you know, it's an interesting landscape, but without, you're right, some of these pay-fors, we're going to see some interesting items.
I think it's interesting to comment, but I think going back to Bush, the federal tax cuts have actually impacted, had an inordinate impact on state. Thinking about the federal state tax, for example, where the state tax credit is essentially eliminated source of income for the states. So these cuts we've seen have had inordinate impact on states.
Yeah, they certainly can. They certainly can. And one of the interesting things we've seen, like with that pass-through entity election where you elect to have maybe the business pay the tax instead of the individual, the state's kind of way of being a safety for that is they've actually charge a higher tax rate than if the individual were to pay it, right? So instead of paying maybe 6%, it's 7.9% if you want the business to do it. So it's still beneficial for the individual, but the state's getting a little bit more money through it. So everyone's trying to get their cut, but it's going to be an interesting year here for sure to see what happens with tax policy. But again, I do think we're going to see some type of tax policy. Hopefully they can get it together. The other thing we're hearing a lot of is that there's a lot of freshman congressmen and women that have never done a budget reconciliation before. Mm-hmm. And so it is not an easy process, and it could take longer as usual than we expect. So hopefully they get their act together, and hopefully, you know, we taxpayers and businesses alike can be encouraged to keep doing business in the U.S. But we're living in an interesting time.
Excellent.
Yes.
Yeah.
Questions?
Yeah. This is maybe for both of you. Maybe it's more a complaint than a question. But it has to do with the IRS. And you mentioned that you're waiting 18 months to get a refund on an overpayment for taxes. I overpaid taxes at one point and was told that unless I go after it, there's no process that has them being audited in a sense to reconcile that they got too much money from me unless I go after it. So actually, who audits the IRS?
Great question. Do you want to take that one?
Well, if they're filling their cookie jar with my money. Okay.
I have to go ahead and answer that one. I've also tried to answer that. I've also got a piece that I just missed.
I think an interesting thing I was listening to similar to that, right? The Department of Defense. Is that what you're saying? The past 20 years has never passed an audit. Never passed an audit, and they never disclosed several accounts, right? So there is something that really came out during the employee retention credit, right? We had a lot of businesses that were hurt. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. We've got a company near Chicago that is a famous frozen pizza business, but they also operate, over 5 pizza stores in the area. Well, their whole pizza business was shut down for COVID. They weren't allowed to serve people and dine in. They were experiencing at first a drop in revenue. We apply for these employee retention credits so they don't have to fire their employees. We're not getting any money. There is something called the Taxpayer Advocate Service, which is an independent branch of the IRS, which of course is convoluted
in the service and auditing.
But I did have success where I would call them, open a case, call them, then call the IRS agent trying to review the file. They would call the IRS agent and it would speed it up maybe to 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And that worked well for about 6 months until they decided they were not going to take any more taxpayer advocate claims. So everyone was experiencing kind of the overage. But it's really us hounding them repeatedly.
Yeah, if you don't hound them, there's no mechanism that will say, oh, look at this guy's return. We better give him that extra money.
No, not at all.
So along those lines, one of the things I was going to mention, the Pentagon. So the Pentagon's got an $824 billion annual budget.
Yeah.
For the last 7 years, they've been trying to get independent audits. There's 28 reporting entities under the Pentagon. And there was just the congressional testimonies by why this came out. Yeah. Out of those 28 entities, 9 received clean opinions for which they were very proud of. So think about that. One was qualified, which means something was wrong, but they could identify what it was. But here's the kicker. 15 of those entities had such disclosure, they didn't have enough information to even determine if it was a clean opinion or not. In other words, a disclaimed opinion, which means they don't know. They can't tell. And I thought it was interesting. I think the commission, whoever is in charge of the Pentagon budget, or maybe it's the, I guess that would fall through the audit, was the federal auditor. They were pretty proud of the fact that they feel within 2 years they can get the Pentagon fully audited. And I know that this was an incentive that was going on for 27 years about having, internal audits. But yeah, they can't. That's the Pentagon. That's probably the largest. I don't know, like the IRS. Good question. That falls under Department of Treasury, right?
Yeah.
I assume the Department of Treasury has to go through
some audit. Or not.
That's a good question.
I'm sure they have some internal controls. I know they're supposed to be doing internal audits, right? But it's a different landscape, right, than a true independent audit.
They certainly find you if you don't pay them tax.
They certainly do.
Yeah.
And where's your interest, right?
And I had to file. It was only like $2,000 or $3,000, but about half that went to the person who filed it.
How did you know that you'd ever filed?
I was going through my paperwork, and I had it as a 1099 form, and I realized I'm looking at my thing. The same form shows up twice. I entered the 1099 bid form twice.
Yeah.
It was very clearly the same form. So right to the penny, everything was identical.
Yeah.
The Office of Inspector General. That's who's responsible for
it. I won't go again. But I was just kind of curious.
Yeah. No, it's a good question. I mean, that's the federal. I think at the state level, they're pretty good. And, even local levels are like universities and so forth. They do have the audit bureau. And so there are entities outside of external level. But
So you mentioned state taxes. So are you saying that depending on how much money you have, you should immediately give everything to your kids?
Or perhaps a trust or something else. Yeah, there's there, we've just seen a huge uptick in that planning, just depending. Obviously, it's for those that you feel you're beyond the threshold or you own a business or something where your share of stock could be worth more than that. But we are seeing a lot of planning around that, and also a lot around charitable trusts, you know, and different charitable giving that they decide, I'd like to move all of this into a trust that's going to continue to accumulate outside of my estate. And so even the impact of getting things out of your estate now that continue to grow, you know, in a protected shelter or a protected entity used for future purposes, either for children, grandchildren, charitable, you know, other items like that. So we're doing a lot of planning around that.
Question here.
Yeah, I was just thinking when I was looking very briefly at the topic for tonight that there would be an opportunity for a more personal dimension of forensic accounting. And my thought is around divorces with self-employed spouses who own companies and they're sole owners or they're LLCs and they're the only person that really, you know, they're not large enough to hide, to require a full audit. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it's such a juicy opportunity to hide money. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the way this could impact individual people in their actual lived lives and children and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and are you saying to the effect of how would the IRS catch those types of individuals in that situation?
No, how would you guys catch it? What kind of forensic accountants can be hired to track down the hidden money of the sneaky, dastardly spouse that's trying to under-report to the court because it's fraud on the court, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's probably an audit perspective to that. From my limited experience and kind of the clients going through divorce, I often see that if people suspect that, they'll have a judge or the court subpoena financial records and bank statements, and then go through, and they also subpoena the tax return and see if that matches up. And a lot of times it doesn't. One of the other big ways that, you know, a lot of self-employed individuals and other small businesses in the past have gotten around some of that is just through Venmo and crypto accounts and PayPal. Now there's kind of the new legislation around 1099 reporting, right? And they're imposing severe penalties now if you're not reporting 1099s on this type of income, typically over $600 or something like that. But now a lot of people are very nervous because the IRS will now have access, which was slightly delayed, I think a year, but will have access to PayPal and Venmo transactions. Mm. And we'll start auditing for that because there is so much around that. And you know, we work with a lot of startups or other companies that, you know, they may get to us post Series A after raising, you know, $10 million or something like that. Hey, our taxes are more complex, our audit's more complex, we need a bigger firm, come work with us. And I look at the last 2 years and they've been paying employees or contractors $10,000, $15,000 out of Venmo, mm-hmm. or PayPal. I say, hey, did you file 1099s for this? And they said, 1090 what?
Exactly.
We've got some issues here. But, you know, I really think, yeah, from a legal perspective, my expectations would need to be a subpoena from the court and comparative of records and maybe hire an accountant to review those. But also, I think there's added scrutiny on transactions, financial transactions through crypto, PayPal, Venmo. The other interesting item is there's been a court case recently around self-employment tax and partnerships. And it used to be kind of acknowledged that if you were a limited partner, not all of your income, you know, maybe there's two partners in the business and Sean here agrees to take all the liability and be our general partner. And I'm going to be the limited partner. And he's got a lot of self-employment tax, but me, some of it's just return on my profit. You know, I'm going to take some for my services, but a lot of it's not. And sometimes that makes a lot of sense, but they, you know, the court feels that people have been abusing that. And so there's been a higher scrutiny now on partnerships on limited partners and what truly is self-employment that you'd have to report in that example as well. So
thank you.